ISIS Audiobooks presents an unabridged recording of Pyramids, written by Terry Pratchett, read by Nigel Planer. Book 1. The Book of Going Forth. Nothing but stars, scattered across the blackness as though the Creator had smashed the windscreen of his car and hadn't bothered to stop to sweep up the pieces. This is the gulf between universes, the chill deeps of space that contain nothing but the occasional random molecule, a few lost comets, and... But a circle of blackness shifts slightly. The eye reconsiders perspective, and what was apparently the awesome distance of interstellar what's-her-name becomes a world under darkness. It stars the lights of what will charitably be called civilization. For as the world tumbles lazily, it is revealed as the disc world. Flat, circular, and carried through space on the back of four elephants who stand on the back of Great Artuin, the only turtle ever to feature on the Hertzsprung-Russell diagram. A turtle 10,000 miles long, dusted with the frost of dead comets, meteor-pocked, albedo-eyed. No one knows the reason for all this, but it is probably quantum. Much that is weird could happen on a world on the back of a turtle like that. It's happening already. The stars below are campfires, out in the desert, and the lights of remote villages high in the forested mountains. Towns are smeared nebulae, cities are vast constellations. The great, sprawling city of Ankh-Morpork, for example, glows like a couple of colliding galaxies. But here, away from the great centres of population, where the Circle Sea meets the desert, there is a line of cold blue fire. Flames as chilly as the slopes of hell roar towards the sky. Ghostly light flickers across the desert. The pyramids in the ancient valley of the Djell are flaring their power into the night. The energy streaming up from their paracosmic peaks may, in chapters to come, illuminate many mysteries. Why tortoises hate philosophy. Why too much religion is bad for goats. And what it is that handmaidens actually do. It will certainly show what our ancestors would be thinking if they were alive today. People have often speculated about this. Would they approve of modern society, they ask? Would they marvel at present-day achievements? And of course this misses a fundamental point. What our ancestors would really be thinking if they were alive today is, why is it so dark in here? In the cool of the river valley dawn, the high priest Dios opened his eyes. He didn't sleep these days. He couldn't remember when he last slept. Sleep was too close to the other thing, and anyway, he didn't seem to need it. Just lying down was enough. At least, just lying down here. The fatigue poisons dwindled away like everything else for a while. Long enough, anyway. He swung his legs off the slab in the little chamber. With barely a conscious prompting from his brain, his right hand grasped the snake-entwined staff of office. He paused to make another mark on the wall, pulled his robe around him, and stepped smartly down the sloping passage and out into the sunlight. The words of the invocation of the new sun already lining up in his mind. The night was forgotten, the day was ahead. There was much careful advice and guidance to be given, and Dios existed only to serve. Dios didn't have the oddest bedroom in the world. It was just the oddest bedroom anyone has ever walked out of. And the sun toiled across the sky. Many people have wondered why. Some people think a giant dung beetle pushes it. As explanations go, it lacks a certain technical edge, and has the added drawback that as certain circumstances may reveal, it is possibly correct. It reached sundown without anything particularly unpleasant happening to it, such as being buried in the sand and having eggs laid in it, and its dying rays chanced to shine in through a window in the city of Ankh-Morpork and gleam off a mirror. It was a full-length mirror. All assassins had a full-length mirror in their rooms, because it would be a terrible insult to anyone to kill them when you were badly dressed. Tepic examined himself critically. The outfit had cost him his last penny, and was heavy on the black silk. It whispered as he moved. It was pretty good. At least the headache was going. It had nearly crippled him all day. He'd been in dread of having to start the run with purple spots in front of his eyes. He sighed and opened the black box and took out his rings and slipped them on. Another box held a set of knives of Clachian steel, their blades darkened with lamp black. Various cunning and intricate devices were taken from velvet bags and dropped into pockets. A couple of long-bladed throwing talingas were slipped into their sheaths inside his boots. A thin silk line and folding grapnel were wound around his waist over the chainmail shirt. A blowpipe was attached to its leather thong and dropped down his back under his cloak. Tepic pocketed a slim tin container with an assortment of darts, their tips corked and their stems braille-coded for ease of selection in the dark. He winced, checked the blade of his rapier and slung the baldric over his right shoulder to balance the bag of lead slingshot ammunition. As an afterthought, he opened his sock drawer and took a pistol crossbow, a flask of oil, a roll of lock picks, and after some consideration, a punch dagger, a bag of assorted caltraps, and a set of brass knuckles. Tepic picked up his hat and checked its lining for the coil of cheese wire. He placed it on his head at a jaunty angle, took a last satisfied look at himself in the mirror, turned on his heel, and very slowly fell over. It was high summer in Ankh-Morpork. In fact, it was more than high, it was stinking. The great river was reduced to a lava-like ooze between Ankh, the city with the better address, and Morpork on the opposite bank. Morpork was not a good address. Morpork was twinned with a tar pit. There was not a lot that could be done to make Morpork a worse place. A direct hit by a meteorite, for example, would count as gentrification. Most of the riverbed was a honeycomb crust of cracked mud. Currently the sun appeared to be a big copper gong nailed to the sky. The heat that had dried up the river fried the city by day and baked it by night, curling ancient timbers, turning the traditional slurry of the streets into a drifting, choking ochre dust. It wasn't Ankh-Morpork's proper weather. It was, by inclination, a city of mists and drips, of slithers and chills. It sat panting on the crisping plains like a toad on a firebrick. And even now, around midnight, the heat was stifling, wrapping the streets like scorched velvet, searing the air and squeezing all the breath out of it. High in the north face of the Assassin's Guild House, there was a click as a window was pushed open. Tepic, who had with considerable reluctance divested himself of some of the heavier of his weapons, took a deep draught of the hot, dead air. This was it. This was the night. They said you had one chance in two, unless you drew old Merisette as examiner, in which case you might as well cut your throat right at the start. Tepic had Merisette for strategy and poison theory every Thursday afternoon, and didn't get along with him. The dormitories buzzed with rumours about Merisette, the number of kills, the astonishing technique. He'd broken all the records in his time. They said he'd even killed the patrician of Ankh-Morpork. Not the present one, that is. One of the dead ones. Maybe it would be Nivor, who was fat and jolly and liked his food, and did traps and deadfalls on Tuesdays. Tepic was good at traps and got on well with the master. Or it could be the Comte de Yo-Yo, who did modern languages and music. Tepic was gifted at neither, but the Comte was a keen edificier, and liked boys who shared his love of dangling by one hand high above the city streets. He stuck one leg over the sill and unhitched his line and grapnel. He hooked the gutter two floors up and slipped out of the window. No assassin ever used the stairs. In order to establish continuity with later events, this may be the time to point out that the greatest mathematician in the history of the Discworld was lying down and peacefully eating his supper. It is interesting to note that, owing to this mathematician's particular species, what he was eating for his supper was his lunch. Gongs around the Ankh-Morpork sprawl were announcing midnight when Tepic crept along the ornate parapet four stories above Filigree Street, his heart pounding. There was a figure outlined against the afterglow of the sunset. Tepic paused alongside a particularly repulsive gargoyle to consider his options. fairly solid classroom rumour said that if he inhumed his examiner before the test, that was an automatic pass. He slipped a number 3 throwing knife from its thigh sheath and hefted it thoughtfully. Of course, any attempt, any overt move which missed, would attract immediate failure and loss of privileges. Breathing, for a start. The silhouette was absolutely still. Tevik's eyes swiveled to the maze of chimneys, gargoyles, ventilator shafts, bridges and ladders that made up the rooftop scenery of the city. Right, he thought. That's some sort of dummy. I'm supposed to attack it, and that means he's watching me from somewhere else. Will I be able to spot him? No. On the other hand, maybe I'm meant to think it's a dummy. Unless he thought of that as well. He found himself drumming his fingers on the gargoyle and hastily pulled himself together. What is the sensible course of action at this point? A party of revelers staggered through a pool of light in the street far below. Tevik sheathed the knife and stood up. Sir, he said, I am here. A dry voice by his ear said, rather indistinctly, Very well. Tevik stared straight ahead. Merisette appeared in front of him, wiping grey dust off his bony face. He took a length of pipe out of his mouth and tossed it aside, then pulled a clipboard out of his coat. He was bundled up even in this heat. Merisette was the kind of person who could freeze in a volcano.
Ah, he said, his voice broadcasting disapproval. Mr. Tevik. Well, well.
A fine night, sir, said Tevik. The examiner gave him a chilly look, suggesting that observations about the weather required an automatic black mark, and made a note on his clipboard.
We'll take a few questions first, he said.
As you wish, sir.
What is the maximum permitted length of a throwing knife?
Snapped Merisette. Tevik closed his eyes. He'd spent the last week reading nothing but the Cordat. He could see the page now, floating tantalizingly just inside his eyelids. They never ask you lengths and weights, students had said knowingly. They expect you to bone up on the weights and lengths and throwing distances, but they never... Naked terror hot-wired his brain and kicked his memory into gear. The page sprang into focus. Maximum length of a throwing knife may be 10 finger widths or 12 in wet weather, he recited. Throwing distance is...
Name 3 poisons acknowledged for administration by ear.
A breeze sprang up, but it did nothing to cool the air. It just shifted the heat about. Sir, wasp agaric, acorion purple, and mustic, sir, said Tevik promptly.
Why not spime?
Snapped Merisette, fast as a snake. Tevik's jaw dropped open. He floundered for a while, trying to avoid the gimlet gaze a few feet away from him. Sir... Spime isn't a poison, sir, he managed. It is an extremely rare antidote to certain snake venoms and is obtained... He settled down a bit, more certain of himself. All those hours idly looking through the old dictionaries had paid off. Is obtained from the liver of the inflatable mongoose, which...
What is the meaning of this sign?
Said Merisette. Is found only in the... Tevik's voice trailed off. He squinted down at the complex rune on the card in Merisette's hand, and then stared straight past the examiner's ear again. "'I haven't the faintest idea, sir,' he said. Out of the corner of his ear, he thought he heard the faintest intake of breath, the tiniest seed of a satisfied grunt. "'But if it were the other way up, sir,' he went on, "'it would be thief sign for noisy dogs in this house.' There was absolute silence for a moment. Then, right by his shoulder, the old assassin's voice said,
"'Is the killing rope permitted to all categories?'
"'Sir, the rules call for 3 questions, sir,' Tevik protested.
"'Ah, and that is your answer, is it?'
"'Sir, no, sir. It was an observation, sir. Sir, the answer you are looking for is that all categories may bear the killing rope, but only assassins of the 3rd grade may use it as one of the 3 options, sir.'
"'You are sure of that, are you?'
"'Sir.'
You wouldn't like to reconsider?
You could have used the examiner's voice to grease a wagon. Sir, no, sir.
Very well.
Tevik relaxed. The back of his tunic was sticking to him, chilly with sweat.
Now I want you to proceed at your own pace towards the street of bookkeepers, said Merisette evenly, obeying all signs and so forth. I will meet you in the room under the gong tower at the junction with Audit Alley. And take this, if you please.
He handed Tepic a small envelope. Tepic handed over a receipt. Then Merisette stepped into the pool of shade beside a chimney pot and disappeared. So much for the ceremony. Tepic took a few deep breaths and tipped the envelope's contents into his hand. It was a guild bond for 10,000 Ankh-Morpork dollars, made out to Bearer. It was an impressive document, surmounted with the guild seal of the double cross and the cloaked dagger. Well, no going back now. He'd taken the money. Either he'd survive, in which case, of course, he'd traditionally donate the money to the guild's widows and orphans fund, or it would be retrieved from his dead body. The bond looked a bit dog-eared, but he couldn't see any bloodstains on it. He checked his knives, adjusted his sword belt, glanced behind him, and set off at a gentle trot. At least this was a bit of luck. The student law said there were only half a dozen routes used during the test, and on summer nights they were alive with students tackling the roofs, towers, eaves, and culls of the city. Edificing was a keen inter-house sport in its own right. It was one of the few things Tepic was sure he was good at. He'd been captain of the team that beat Scorpion House in the wall game finals, and this was one of the easiest courses. He dropped lightly over the edge of the roof, landed on a ridge, ran easily across the sleeping building, jumped a narrow gap onto the tiled roof of the Young Men's Reformed Cultists of the Ikor God Bel Shamharoth Association gym, jogged gently over the grey slope, swarmed up a 12-foot wall without slowing down, and vaulted onto the wide flat roof of the Temple of Blind Io. A full orange moon hung on the horizon. There was a real breeze up here. Not much, but as refreshing as a cold shower after the stifling heat of the streets. He speeded up, enjoying the coolness on his face, and leapt accurately off the end of the roof onto the narrow plank bridge that led across Tin Lid Alley, and which someone, in defiance of all probability, had removed. At times like this, one's past life flashes before one's eyes. His aunt had wept rather theatrically, Tepic had thought, since the old lady was as tough as a hippo's instep. His father had looked stern and dignified, whenever he could remember to, and tried to keep his mind free of beguiling images of cliffs and fish. The servants had been lined up along the hall from the foot of the main stairway, handmaidens on one side, eunuchs and butlers on the other. The women bobbed a curtsy as he walked by, creating a rather nice sine-wave effect, which the greatest mathematician on the disc, had he not at this moment been occupied by being hit with a stick and shouted at by a small man wearing what appeared to be a nightshirt, might well have appreciated. "But," Tepic's aunt blew her nose, "it's trade, after all." His father patted her hand. "Nonsense, flower of the desert," he said. "It is a profession, at the very least."
"What is the difference?" she sobbed.
The old man sighed.
"The money, I understand. It will do him good to go out into the world and make friends and have a few corners knocked off, and it will keep him occupied and prevent him from getting into mischief."
"But assassination! He's so young, and he's never shown the least inclination."
She dabbed at her eyes.
"It's not from our side of the family," she added accusingly. "That brother-in-law of yours..."
"Uncle Wirt," said his father.
"Going all over the world killing people."
"I don't believe they use that word," said his father. "I think they prefer words like conclude, or annul, or inhume, I understand."
"Inhume?"
"I think it's like exhume, oh flooding of the waters, only it's before they bury you."
"I think it's terrible," she sniffed. "But I heard from Lady Nooney that only one boy in 15 actually passes the final exam. Perhaps we'd better let him get it out of his system."
King Tepikaimon the 27th nodded gloomily and went by himself to wave goodbye to his son. He was less certain than his sister about the unpleasantness of assassination. He'd been reluctantly in politics for a long time and felt that while assassination was probably worse than debate, it was certainly better than war, which some people tended to think of as the same thing, only louder. and there was no doubt that young Wirt always had plenty of money, and used to turn up at the palace with expensive gifts, exotic suntans, and thrilling tales of the interesting people he'd met in foreign parts, in most cases quite briefly. He wished Wirt was around to advise. His Majesty had also heard that only one student in 15 actually became an assassin. He wasn't entirely certain what happened to the other 14, but he was pretty sure that if you were a poor student in a school for assassins, they did a bit more than throw the chalk at you, and that the school dinners had an extra dimension of uncertainty. But everyone agreed that the assassin school offered the best all-round education in the world. A qualified assassin should be at home in any company, and able to play at least one musical instrument. Anyone inhumed by an alumnus of the guild school could go to his rest satisfied that he had been annulled by someone of taste and discretion. And after all, what was there for him at home? A kingdom 2 miles wide and 150 miles long, which was almost entirely underwater during the flood season, and threatened on either side by stronger neighbours who tolerated its existence only because they'd be constantly at war if it wasn't there. Oh, the Jelly Baby had been great once, literally, child of the Dajel, when upstarts like Tassort and Ephib were just a bunch of nomads with their towels on their heads. All that remained of those great days was the ruinously expensive palace, a few dusty ruins in the desert, and, the pharaoh sighed, the pyramids. Always the pyramids. His ancestors had been keen on pyramids. The pharaoh wasn't. Pyramids had bankrupted the country, drained it drier than the river ever did. The only curse they could afford to put on a tomb these days was bugger off. The only pyramids he felt comfortable about were the very small ones at the bottom of the garden, built every time one of the cats died. He'd promised the boy's mother. He missed Artella. There'd been a terrible row about taking a wife from outside the kingdom, and some of her foreign ways had puzzled and fascinated even him. Maybe it was from her he'd got the strange dislike of pyramids. In the Jelly Baby, that was like disliking breathing. But he'd promised that Ptepik could go to school outside the kingdom. She'd been insistent about that. "People never learn anything in this place," she'd said. "They only remember things." If only she'd remembered about not swimming in the river. He watched two of the servants load Tepic's trunk onto the back of the coach, and for the first time either of them could remember, laid a paternal hand on his son's shoulder. In fact, he was at a loss for something to say. "We've never really had time to get to know one another," he thought. "There's so much I could have given him. A few bloody good hidings wouldn't have come amiss." He said, "Well, my boy."
"Yes, father?"
"This is, the first time you've been away from home by yourself."
"No, father. I spent last summer with Lord Fem Ptahem, you remember?"
"Oh, did you?" The pharaoh recalled the palace had seemed quieter at the time. He'd put it down to the new tapestries. "Anyway," he said, "you're a young man, nearly 13.
12, father," said Tepic patiently.
"Are you sure?"
"It was my birthday last month, father. You bought me a warming pan."
"Did I? How singular. Did I say why?"
"No, father."
Tepic looked up at his father's mild, puzzled features.
"It was a very good warming pan," he added reassuringly. "I like it a lot."
"Oh, good. His Majesty patted his son's shoulder again, in a vague way, like a man drumming his fingers on his desk while trying to think. An idea appeared to occur to him. The servants had finished strapping the trunk onto the roof of the coach, and the driver was patiently holding open the door. "When a young man sets out in the world," said His Majesty uncertainly, "there are... it's very important that he remembers... the point is that it is a very big world, after all, with all sorts, and of course especially so in the city, where there are many additional..." He paused, waving one hand vaguely in the air. Tepic took it gently. "It's quite all right, father," he said. "Dios, the high priest, explained to me about taking regular baths and not going blind." His father blinked at him.
"You're not going blind?" he said.
"Apparently not, father."
"Oh, well, jolly good," said the king. "Jolly, jolly good. That is good news." I think I had better be going, Father, otherwise I shall miss the tide. His Majesty nodded and patted his pockets.
There was something, he muttered, and then tracked it down and slipped a small leather bag into Tepic's pocket.
He tried the shoulder routine again.
A little something, he murmured. Don't tell your aunt.
Oh, you can't, anyway. She's gone for a lie down. It's all been rather too much for her. All that remained then was for Tepic to go and sacrifice a chicken at the statue of Kuft, the founder of Djeli Baby, so that his ancestor's guiding hand would steer his footsteps in the world. It was only a small chicken, though, and when Kuft had finished with it, the king had it for lunch. Djeli Baby really was a small, self-centred kingdom. Even its plagues were half-hearted. All self-respecting river kingdoms have vast supernatural plagues, but the best the old kingdom had been able to achieve in the last 100 years was the plague of frog. It was quite a big frog, however, and got into the air ducts and kept everyone awake for weeks. That evening, when they were all well outside the delta of the Djel and heading across the Circle Sea to Ankh Morpork, Tepic remembered the bag and examined its contents. With love, but also with his normal approach to things, his father had presented him with a cork, half a tin of saddle soap, a small bronze coin of uncertain denomination, and an extremely elderly sardine. It is a well-known fact that when one is about to die, the senses immediately become excruciatingly sharp. And it has always been believed that this is to enable their owner to detect any possible exit from his predicament, other than the obvious one. This is not true. The phenomenon is a classic example of displacement activity. The senses are desperately concentrating on anything apart from the immediate problem, which in Tepic's case consisted of a broad expanse of cobblestones, some 80 feet away and closing, in the hope that it will go away. The trouble is that it soon will. Whatever the reason, Tepic was suddenly acutely aware of things around him, the way the moonlight glowed on the rooftops, the smell of fresh bread wafting from a nearby bakery, the whirring of a cockchafer as it barreled past his ear, upwards, the sound of a baby crying in the distance, and the bark of a dog, the gentle rush of the air, with particular reference to its thinness and lack of handholds. There had been more than 70 of them enrolling that year. The assassins didn't have a very strenuous entrance examination. The school was easy to get into, easy to get out of. The trick was to get out upright. The courtyard in the centre of the guild buildings was thronged with boys who all had two things in common: overlarge trunks, which they were sitting on, and clothes that had been selected for them to grow into, and which they were more or less sitting in. Some optimists had brought weapons with them, which were confiscated and sent home over the next few weeks. Tepic watched them carefully. There were distinct advantages to being the only child of parents too preoccupied with their own affairs to worry too much about him, or indeed register his existence for days at a time. His mother, as far as he could remember, had been a pleasant woman and as self-centred as a gyroscope. She liked cats. She didn't just venerate them, everyone in the kingdom did that, but she actually liked them too. Tepic knew that it was traditional in river kingdoms to approve of cats, but he suspected that usually the animals in question were graceful, stately creatures. His mother's cats were small, spitting, flat-headed, yellow-eyed maniacs. His father spent a lot of time worrying about the kingdom and occasionally declaring that he was a seagull, although this was probably from general forgetfulness. Tepic had occasionally speculated about his own conception, since his parents were rarely in the same frame of reference, let alone the same state of mind. But it had apparently happened, and he was left to bring himself up on a trial-and-error basis, mildly hindered and occasionally enlivened by a succession of tutors. The ones hired by his father were best, especially on those days when he was flying as high as he could, and for one glorious winter, Tepic had as his tutor an elderly ibis poacher who had in fact wandered into the royal gardens in search of a stray arrow. That had been a time of wild chases with soldiers, moonlight rambles in the dead streets of the necropolis, and best of all, the introduction to the punt bow, a fearsomely complicated invention which, at considerable risk to its operators, could turn a sloughful of innocent waterfowl into so much floating pate. He'd also had the run of the library, including the locked shelves. The poacher had several other skills to ensure gainful employment in inclement weather, which had given him many hours of quiet study. He was particularly attached to the Shuttered Palace, translated from the Kalian by a gentleman with hand-coloured plates for the connoisseur in a strictly limited edition.
It was confusing but instructive. And when a rather fey young tutor, engaged by the priests, tried to introduce him to certain athletic techniques favoured by the classical pseudopolitans, Tepic considered the suggestion for some time and then floored the youth with a hat stand. Tepic hadn't been educated. Education had just settled on him like dandruff.